Are we live? Good to see you. You're here. You get to participate. We're very happy to have you here. You're not here yet. Get in here. This is the final session of our meeting. So far, I feel like we've got a point of light, or whatever they used to call it in the Bush lexicon, a real point of light in an otherwise not so lit up world. And I am just stoked. This is a wonderful occasion. There's so much interesting and valuable interchange going on. We're going to try to contribute. The best way we can do that is to get on with the business at hand and leave time at the end for there to be some question and answer discussion. I have two further points. I should say I'm Dan Schiller. I'm a professor here at the U of I, and my role is to facilitate and help people here who are going to give the real content. I've got two small further points to make, small not in the sense that they're intellectually insignificant, but that they won't take long. The first is, when we're finished, please don't rush the stage. We are all interested in having friends and connections, but we've been informed by the authorities that that's not allowed. So please don't rush the stage. The second point is of a totally different order. I have just been handed a copy of a new book, literally hot off the press, The Future of Media. This is co-edited by Bob McChesney, Russell Newman, and Ben Scott. And it is, I think, volume that comes out of reflections on the previous Media Reform Conference. Let's see if we can't make those Amazon.com sites hum, if you're going to go that route, or maybe even just try your old library or old bookstore in the local community. It looks like a winner, and how could it not be with this cast of characters and the subtitle Resistance and Reform in the 21st Century? So there you got it.
Pages for All. Go to Pages for All.
I'm going to now introduce very briefly our speakers in the order that they will speak. The first speaker is Ben Scott, co-editor of The Future of Media, policy director for Free Press, an organization that advocates for public awareness and participation in media policy and reform. The second speaker will be Bill Fletcher, Jr., the president and CEO of Trans-Africa Forum, and a former executive with the AFL-CIO, whose words I was able to use effectively in a course soon after the events of September 11th, because he was one of the few people who immediately had some usable words that could be integrated for those of us trying to move in a different direction from the mainstream policies. Third will be Amy Goodman, host of Pacifica Network's Democracy Now! News program, and such a valuable resource in so many ways, as we have had evidence of repeatedly at this conference. I couldn't sleep last night after listening to your talk, and so I'll hold that against you for the rest of the day. But thank you so much for being here, all of you, and now I'm going to turn it over to Ben Scott. Ben.
Thank you, and good afternoon. It's good to be in Champaign-Urbana. As some of you in the audience know, I am a native son of the community, and I always enjoy coming home. It also reminds me that my adventures in Washington policy are distracting me from my Midwestern dissertation. I begin my talk by admitting up front that my public speaking is encumbered by my two dueling professions as an academic and as a policy lobbyist. I think two more opaque vocabularies can hardly be found outside of the courtroom and the hospital. But this fact in itself is actually a part of the meaning of my talk. I intend to approach some issues that don't get a lot of play in conferences, don't get a lot of play in the media because they are difficult, technocratic legislative issues that are nonetheless important. And I found in my 2 years in Washington that to do the work of the people in Congress and at the Federal Communications Commission, you must learn the language of power. It is a language that is designed to exclude. It is a process that is designed to deter public participation. It is no surprise that when no public representatives knock on the door, when the laws are being written, that the corporate interests and their paid politicians don't bother to allow us a seat at the table. My job as a policy director for Free Press, an organization devoted to public participation in media policy, is to get in the door and get all of us a seat at that table. So that brings me to the purpose at hand today. One is to give you the lay of the land of the key media policy issues that are ongoing in Washington that will shape the future of the media scape for all of us. I think it's critical that we recognize right now, right away, that media ownership, though a very important fight, is not the only fight. It's the only one that gets a lot of talk and a lot of attention these days because it's the one that really blew up and got a lot of public attention. Meanwhile, our very well-organized and very well-funded opponents have stolen a march on us and have their troops in position on a variety of new fronts in the legislative arena that will impact the future of our media as profoundly or more profoundly than media ownership. I'm going to present a few of those to you today as a way of a warning shot across the bow. I will offer an analysis of why it is that in each of these cases, the policies that are under consideration are heading in the wrong direction. We did a great thing on media ownership, and we held the line, and we stopped big media from getting bigger, but the game's not over, and we're getting beaten very badly in a number of different other issues, which I'll explain. And finally, I'm going to get to how scholars and activists and community leaders and concerned citizens can get involved to good effect. So, what are we all here to discuss? We have a conference about media consolidation. We have raised the question of whether there's a problem of corruption in public policy. We've raised the question of whether this corruption has been had a negative impact on the democratic involvement in our society. Yes, of course, all of these things are true. All of us in this room, I would wager, understand that these are problems. So why do we keep calling conferences to talk about them? Why are we talking about problems that we already understand? The reason why we're keeping on talking about the problems is because most people don't recognize that there's a problem. They don't see it because the problems in the media have become so much a part of the status quo. They are a given. They are a part of the background. They are in the atmosphere. They are not something that stand out, that scream, hey, this is a problem, the way other issues in our society do. That's the real problem. That's what we're all here to talk about. We're identifying, articulating the problems in the media so that we can go out and talk about them some more. That's the way you change things in this society. Our work, I think, operates along a model for changing social policy. And there are four steps that we do. First, we identify the problem. We've done that. Second, we take it out into the public and we try to infuse a common sense understanding amongst all of our fellow citizens that there's a problem. It's a public education effort. The third step is we present sensible alternatives, and we pair that with aggressive outreach to try to force these alternatives into the policy process. And in the fourth step, we organize the public support that recognizes the problem to get behind the solutions and to make change. We're still in stages one and two. We haven't got to three and four yet. We need to concentrate very hard on spreading the word about the problems outside of this venue, out into the community beyond us. Let me tell you a little bit about the model of social change that is practiced by the corporate interests in the telecommunications business in the broadcasting industry. They don't identify problems per se. They don't talk to the public at all. What they do is they have a two-step model. And the first step is to give a lot of money to politicians during campaigns. And the second step is, after they're elected, go tell them what to do. It's a very effective model. It's a far more effective model than ours, I'm afraid. Unfortunately, we don't have that kind of money, and so we have to organize people, which is, in the end, a more profound and more powerful model, but it takes more effort. So in Washington right now, for those of you who remember the bleak outcome of last year, those folks won the election, and now they're in a long line outside the White House and outside the Congress, and they're getting their tickets punched. That's what it means is the thousands of lobbyists all over the Capitol Hill every day doing the work of their companies. And I've met a lot of these people. They're no longer a sort of faceless enemy of democracy to me. They're real people. They are doing their jobs. They believe that this is the way the game is played and this is the way things work, and to do things otherwise is naive. And it is up to us to bring back democracy, to organize people, to invest the policy process with a public voice again. And it's a difficulty. And it's a difficulty because of the reason that I first raised at the beginning of the talk. And it's a problem of language, and it's a problem of complexity. The major issues before the Congress today are not media ownership. Media ownership is not in front of the Congress, still bogged down in the courts. The Federal Communications Commission is considering taking up media ownership issues again. It will be several months before we have a decision one way or another on whether they're even to consider these rules again. In the meantime, we're faced with several very important issues. The first I want to mention is digital television. Digital television, something that we've heard about for many years. It was meant to be inaugurated in 1996, and we were all to have digital television by 2002, and analog would be over, the old broadcast system would end. That didn't happen. It wasn't profitable. They are just now revising and reviewing the laws for the DTV transition. What does this mean in real terms? What it means is that a big chunk of the public airwaves that we own, just as we own the national parks, the big chunk of the public airwaves is going to be turned over to us, to the people, to our government, to our representatives, by the broadcasters who have had license to that public spectrum for years. And when they give it back, we will have the option to decide what to do with it. This spectrum is worth several hundred billion dollars. It's a resource that we all share. And there is no discussion whatsoever about what we ought to do with it with the public. Right now, that spectrum, that slice of the public airwaves that is now occupied by the broadcasters and will soon be vacated in the part of, as broadcasters go digital, is slated for auction to the cell phone companies. It's as if they took Yellowstone National Park and they put it on the auction block and they sold it off to coal miners and condo developers and never asked anybody in the public what their opinion was about it. And people don't know because it's spectrum, it's radio frequencies. What are you talking about? That's the end of the story. It's not in the media. Nobody knows anything about it. $100 billion. That's the amount of money the government can get for it. And as the government today is deeply in debt, deeply in need of resources to pay for foreign policy adventures, all of the public airwaves that are coming back in the digital transition are currently slated for auction. We have no voice in the process. We are currently trying to figure out what it is that we can ask for. They've told us, you're not going to get any of those airwaves for the people. You're not going to get any of the money that we bring in from auctioning it off. Sorry about that. The deal has already been done. The fix is in. Sorry, it's over. Digital television is something that we need to get involved in. Public airwaves. Everybody in this country ought to know that the people own the airwaves. It's a resource that we all share. Why is it being auctioned off by the government to cellular phone companies that have no accountability to us? That's number one. Number two, broadband. Another one of the technical buzzwords of telecommunications policy. Broadband just means high-speed internet access. High-speed internet access increasingly is becoming as a necessity. It's a necessity for economic growth. It's a necessity for educational opportunities. It's a necessity for advances in telemedicine. Those without access to the internet are falling behind. So what have we done to promote and expand the availability of universal access to high-speed internet? What have we done to lower prices so that people in low-income neighborhoods can afford it? What have we done to make sure that folks in rural areas who don't have access can get online? We've done nothing. In fact, we have gone to the two industries that control the broadband universe, the cable companies and the telephone companies, and we have paid them hundreds of millions of dollars to build out broadband networks, public dollars. And they've responded by putting the money in their back pocket and saying, thank you very much. So what's happened is actually a remarkable thing. Out in the Midwest, around here, Iowa, Illinois, Nebraska, people have begun to build their own broadband networks using low-cost wireless broadband technologies. Right here in Champaign-Urbana, you have one of the world's most amazing technological developments produced by engineers trained right here on campus at the Computer Science Labs. They're building a wireless broadband system to deliver universal, affordable, high-speed internet access to the public for free as a public utility. It's an idea that people understand intuitively. Yeah, free broadband access would be great. People ought to have access to the internet when they rent an apartment or buy a house, just like there's a water pipe that comes up under the house, just like there are electrical wires that go into their house. These are tools for the 21st century economy. They are tools for the 21st century family. Everyone ought to have them. The response from the telecommunications industry and from the cable companies has been to go to state legislatures and to the federal government and argue that it is unfair for the public to compete in a private market for communications. It's just not fair for someone to come along and offer a service for free that they're charging $50 a month for. Clearly, this is a violation of the American way and must be put a stop to immediately. It doesn't pass the laugh test. It doesn't pass the laugh test, and yet in a dozen states this year alone, these companies have paid their legislators. These companies have paid their legislators to introduce bills into state houses to prohibit public entities, city governments, schools, universities, electrical utilities, nonprofits, from offering broadband to those who don't have it, from offering internet to those who can't afford it. This has gone on at the state level all year long. In some cases, they have been successful. In some cases, they have not. The state legislatures will close down their sessions in June for the year. Some for the next 2 years. They meet so irregularly. And the fight will be carried to Capitol Hill. Already, the telephone companies have lined up support in the House of Representatives. And they made their allies in powerful committees and powerful places have made statements in public saying, it's not fair that these companies have to compete against the public. We ought to make it illegal for people to build their own broadband networks. It's not a story that's made the nightly news anytime recently. It's not a story that's in the newspaper, but it's a story that's going to impact you and your daily life immediately. It means that for the next 10 years, you're going to pay $50 a month for your broadband connection. What that means is that the 70% of the United States that doesn't have access to broadband today will continue to not have access to broadband tomorrow. What it means is that the 35% of Americans who don't own computers today will have no incentive to own computers tomorrow. What it means is that the social inequalities built on communications and information inequalities will continue and be perpetuated. These are the kind of decisions that are made in the technocratic language of commerce committees in the House and Senate of the United States that impact us in our living rooms and at our desks, in our workplaces and at our schools, and it's time that we got involved. Let me move on to something that is a little closer to home, and that's public broadcasting. Right here in Champaign-Urbana, you have one of the best public broadcasting systems in the country that I know of, WILL. A rarity in the current media environment that pays close attention to local news, that pays close attention to local culture, that does its best to interface with the community to find out what media really matters to the folks who listen and watch. Corporation for Public Broadcasting is the entity in Washington that delivers financing to each of the public broadcasting stations across the country. It was developed in the 1960s as an institution to protect public broadcasting from the political influence of Congress. When Congress gave money to public media, they didn't want political strings to be attached, so they invented this corporation to provide a heat shield to protect public broadcasting from that political influence. Today, we have the chairman of the board of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting has taken it upon himself on our behalf to decide that public broadcasting is biased to the left, and that he should personally insist that PBS carry conservative programming, that he should personally insist that Bill Moyers be given a permanent monitor to make sure that his content is not imbalanced. Interestingly, under this chairman, Ken Tomlinson, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, did a survey, and they asked the public, do you think that PBS and NPR are fair and balanced? And they hired a Republican pollster to do the survey, and it is clear that they intended to get a result that showed that their policies of shifting public broadcasting to the right were the will of the public. Unfortunately, when they asked the people what they thought, they got the wrong answer. 80% of the country said public broadcasting was fair and balanced. 80%. Show me an issue where 80% of Americans agree on anything. It shows the power of local broadcasting. It shows the power of local media. People don't want to see the tools of communications, the tools of democracy taken out of their communities. They want to have accountability. They want to know the station managers. They want to know the hosts of the local radio shows. They want to be able to call in and be recognized. They want to know that the issues that matter to them and their community will be heard. All of these decisions that affect us in our living rooms, whether it's from our public radio station, whether it is the cost and availability of our high-speed internet connection, or whether it is our birthright, the public spectrum being auctioned off without our consent and without our knowledge, all these things are going on at the federal government unbeknownst to us. It is time that we got involved. It is time that we got active, articulating the problem to the public. That is the key. People don't understand there's a problem. I'll close with this anecdote, which is the core of the organizing challenge that we face, the greatest opportunity and yet the greatest frustration in the work that I do. I go out and I give a talk like this, and those folks who understand the problem, it takes about 5 minutes for me to persuade them what the solution is. If you don't understand the problem, you're not interested in the solution. And why should you be? But as a group, one by one, conversation by conversation, with friends and with family and with colleagues, we can articulate the problem. We can make the problems of the media identified at this conference a part of a general common sense, so that when we gather in a forum like this, when we gather in a forum in church basements or in civic centers across the country, everyone will know what the problem is and the debate will be about the solutions. When we get there, we'll have change. Thanks very much.
Very much. Now I'll turn it over to Bill Fletcher.
Thank you and good afternoon. I was both honored and surprised when Bob McChesney invited me to participate in his conference and in the conference in St. Louis. I'm not someone rooted in the media reform movement, and it somewhat reminded me of shortly after I started my job as president of Trans-Africa Forum, I had a talk with our board chair, Danny Glover, and I said, Danny, I'm feeling kind of weird about this job. You know, I'm not an Africa policy specialist. I'm no policy wonk. I said, you know, I'm a troublemaker. And he said, yeah, I know. That's why we wanted you. So perhaps I'm hoping that that's why Bob wanted me here today. I had prepared some remarks, and then I was listening to the earlier panel, and I decided that what I had to say was fairly trite. So I wanted to take a different angle. About a year or so ago, a friend of mine from South Africa was visiting here and stayed with me and my family. And he sat at the television and was looking at it very quietly. And then he turned to me and said, Bill, in the United States, you have so many stations, but there's not shit on TV. I'm not sure that I need to add anything more to that. You know, except that when I was driving here from St. Louis this morning, The good side was that I could go like a bat out of hell. But the bad side was that when I was a few miles out of St. Louis, I started feeling like my South African friend, except with regard to radio. There was very little to listen to. And this led me to start thinking about this, that people generally think about freedom of the press as basically the absence of overt repression. Yet my concern today is that the actual absence of freedom of the press in the United States is a problem not rooted in media consolidation, but it's rooted in the dynamics of actual U.S. capitalism. And part of what strikes me is that this audience should be at least a third people of color. It should be at least a third people of color. Yet part of the problem when the way that we often look at the issue of media reform and the way that we look at the freedom of the press is that we make certain assumptions. That is, we exclude certain very, very important information. So, for example, African Americans have been fighting a battle for freedom of the press for a very long time. When it comes to whether it's the printed media, radio, or television, there has been no level playing field. This has nothing to do with media consolidation. It has to do with the racial dynamics of U.S. capitalism, and it's something that every media reform advocate should embrace. It's just as the African Americans were excluded from other key sectors of the economy, whether it was steel, auto, rubber, whatever, there has never been a level playing field, a point that I will come back to at the very end of my remarks. So when we talk about freedom of the press, we have to always understand that it's been premised on money, but it as well has been premised on certain racial and gender biases. Now, media consolidation, which I would suggest is typical of what we see in a monopoly stage of capitalism, is significant, but I would say it is not the source of the problem that we're looking at in terms of the erosion of freedom of the press. But that the erosion, the imminent threat that we're facing, or the immediate threat that we're facing, is really compounded by several different dynamics, one being the political shift to the right, which accompanied the rise of neoliberal globalization. And with this rise of neoliberal globalization, there has been an absolute assault on the notion of anything public, and an absolute assault on anything or anyone that stands in the way of the unfettered accumulation of capital. And so I think that when we're looking at this threat to the freedom of the press, we have to be very, very careful, because while media consolidation certainly affects the situation and helps to lay the context in which this current battle is taking place, I would suggest to you that it is not by itself the cause, and that actually what we're looking at is a much more fundamental battle around democracy in this country, and that the battle around freedom of the press is linked to the erosion overall of democracy and civil liberties. So what do we do? Do we hand out the Kool-Aid? No. I would say that there's three things that we need to take up, and I want to build on the last remarks. One is that we absolutely need a broad front in the struggle around immediate issues, such as the struggle that took place in response to Michael Powell and his efforts to move the FEC guidelines. I think that was very, very important. But we have to recognize that was a defensive battle. The second thing is that we really need to be thinking much more broadly and recognizing that the factors that are at play are fundamentally political, and that until we build a broad political block of the dispossessed, until we are actually thinking on the level of the fight for political power, recognizing that the decisions that are being made are fundamentally political ones, we will constantly find ourselves on the defensive. And within that context, Danny Glover and I had wrote an article about the notion of a neo-rainbow strategy. I think that it's important to be thinking at that level, that we have to take the battle for democracy, we have to move it away from the defensive and rearticulate it as an offensive struggle for restructuring this country, which leads to my final point. We have to demythologize U.S. democracy. There's this notion that there once was a level playing field. Now, this is a very, very seductive notion, and it's particularly seductive for white people in the United States, because people really would like to believe that. I mean, if we want to be honest about this, people really would like to believe that once upon a time there was a level playing field, and then all of a sudden this playing field became less level. Maybe it was because of monopolies, maybe it was because of corruption or whatever, but that we basically have to turn back the clock. Now, part of the danger with this myth is that it fits very well with right-wing populism. And many of us on the left and progressive side of the aisle sometimes are not clear enough about the dangers that emerge from the right. But we have to be very, very clear that part of our job really has to be to demythologize the history of this country so that we understand the program that we need to advance for the future. Democracy in the United States has always been skewed on class, gender, and racial basis. And so that there was never a moment when there was this mythological playing field, level playing field. Without demythologizing this reality and without broadening our conception of media reform and democracy, I would suggest that we're going to go nowhere, that we will remain people with very, very strong opinions, very articulate, but we will be completely ineffective, because ultimately, to win this battle means winning the battle for political power. Thank you.
Thank you. And now, Amy Goodman.
Before I began my remarks, I wanted to ask Ben a question. You ended on the issue of PBS and CPB and what is happening there. And I was just wondering if you could elaborate a little more for people and say what you're campaigning around on that issue.
Sure. I'm happy to. I was running out of time and didn't want to do that, go over my limit. We believe that the only answer to top-down pressure on public broadcasting is bottom-up pressure on public broadcasting. In response to the activities of the political meddlers in Washington, Free Press and a number of other organizations that represent hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of constituents across the country, have called for a series of town meetings where the people come out and they meet with their station managers or their local public television and radio stations, and they have a dialogue about what public broadcasting ought to look like in the future. And they build a public record, and they go together to Washington and they say, whatever you've been doing, throw it aside. This is what's happening. We are the people. These are our stations. You will do as we say. You are our representatives. There is no other voice that these folks are going to listen to. So at the base, the answer is local organizing.
And then specifically with the latest news of the monitoring that's going on by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and who is now in charge. I don't know if people are even aware of that.
Sure. Twisted little irony of the Washington world. The chairman of the board of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, Ken Tomlinson, hired as his chief operating officer Ken Faree. Ken Faree was Michael Powell's chief hatchet man in the media ownership rules proceeding. The man in charge of public interest broadcasting was also the man in charge of the destruction of public interest rules on media ownership. If that's not Orwellian, I don't know what is.
And one of the top people at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting was pulled over from the Office of Global Communications in the White House. And so you have that kind of pressure from the top down. And you have this very critical point that Bill Fletcher is talking about is who frames the debate and let's start reframing what that discussion is. And I think that's a good paradigm. It's the idea of the frame. What are we looking at? What is television looking at today? What are the questions they're asking? That determines the answers they're getting. And it's all about a very narrow discussion that gives you the illusion of debate that no matter what preserves and reinforces the status quo, particularly because you have this illusion of a discussion when most people are outside of that frame. It doesn't matter what the network is, and it's not just Fox. It's CBS, NBC, ABC, CNN. They bring you this small circle of pundits who know so little about so much, explaining the world to us. And that's what we have to challenge. They have hijacked our airwaves, and that is the greatest threat to our democracy. Because our country and the world has gotten so big, there are so many people, that we can't possibly meet each other personally. A few of us can, and that's how we understand each other, and those are personal relationships. But most of the world, we understand through the media. In this country, we understand each other. And through that corporate lens, we understand the rest of the world. And perhaps most dangerous, the rest of the world understands us. Our image is projected through that lens. During the Persian Gulf War, who owned that lens? CBS was owned by Westinghouse, now it's owned by Viacom. NBC was owned by General Electric. At the time, Westinghouse and General Electric, two of the major nuclear weapons manufacturers in the world, making most of the parts for most of the weapons in the Persian Gulf War, are bringing us coverage of that war. Is it any accident that what we watched looked like a military hardware show? And you have the network reporters, and now equality is when women as well as men can climb into the tanks or the helicopters and show us what it's like to look down and see the target. But what does it feel like to be at the target end? That's where we're supposed to be, to go to where the silence is, where the majority of people are. Think about if we had a media in this country that dealt with the issues proportionate to the crises that were there. Last night I was talking about the Terri Schiavo case and how I was speaking to someone who that week was at a meeting in France of international healthcare providers dealing with TB and malaria. Millions of people dying in the world, and even they found their discussions were all about whether Terri Schiavo would live or die. It's astounding the power of the media. Now let's think about what would happen if every day the media talked about the issues proportionate to the problems. Genocide in Darfur. Could you imagine? In the same way that every day we looked at the Terri Schiavo case, imagine what you can learn for 24 hours a day. Imagine the pressure that would build. We learn from the media doing the right thing and covering the tsunami, going there, letting us see the suffering of people, that it doesn't matter what color people are, that the media can fight racism. Because no matter what color people are, when you see a little girl who lost her mother, brown, black, white, yellow, red, it doesn't matter. You care. And the outpouring of support absolutely proved that. Most people were not white who suffered in the tsunami. Yet we've never seen this level of money going from one place to another. We need to see that every day. When it comes to people suffering, people respond. And that is the power of the media because it makes everything so intimate, so immediate. Haiti. I won't talk about the situation again as I did last night, but right now, Yvonne Neptune, the ousted prime minister, is near death. He is wavering between consciousness and unconsciousness on a 23-day hunger fast in jail since last June as a result of a coup last February that the U.S. was involved with. You've got Aristide in exile in South Africa. You've got the prime minister in jail dying. Imagine if every day the media said, and today it's day 24 of the hunger fast of the democratically elected prime minister of the oldest black republic in the world, just miles from Florida. Everyone would care. The story has to be repeated over and over. I'd say about 5 times in a week. And then it becomes a part of the conversation. That's what the media does. It provides the table for the conversation. As I always say, I see the media as a huge kitchen table that stretches across this country, actually stretches across the globe, that we all sit around and debate and discuss the most important issues of the day, life and death, war and peace. And everyone's at that table. And we look at the pressing issues and we say, what is going to be done about it? Instead, you had after the coup in February, and Aristide is ousted, they send him to a country. Those in power are very savvy. They are very also media aware. They know they have to define the debate early, and they got to be the ones to do it. They don't want others at the table. And so you push Aristide out of the picture. He's in a place, and this isn't a trivial point, where it's difficult even to make a cell phone call, let alone leave the country, and then say he's free to leave. He and the First Lady of Haiti have just taken up residence in this remote area of Africa. It's hard to understand him on a cell phone. It's sort of like making a cell phone call from this room. I don't know how you guys in this very sophisticated indie media city, every place I go, I'm having trouble making cell phone calls, but I'm trying to wean myself from them. But and so when you have the whole government apparatus at press conferences talking about Aristide having resigned and leaving the country, and finally you see on CNN Anderson Cooper, and he's interviewing President Aristide, and he says, isn't it true you're inspiring violence? Or isn't it true you resigned? What did you say? What are you trying to say? I mean, you don't have any idea if he can speak English or not. You don't understand at all what he is saying. And it's like he is speaking through a comb, and you have this aggressive reporter who's been fed information from the government, and nothing is countering that information. Because the way the media works, they will take a phone call, the head of the networks or the head of the newsroom, for someone in power. That call will get right through. But if you have someone from the grassroots who calls up, hardly will that phone call get through, complaining, where is the coverage? I remember seeing Maxine Waters, who was presenting a different point of view on this issue, and that was pretty rare. And she said that what the government was saying wasn't true. And the actual shock, you could feel the visceral shock of the host saying, are you saying the government is lying? Why would there be any reason for them not to tell the truth, they said. Now, that's a fair question if you also ask it of the government officials. If you say, why are you saying this? If you treat everyone equally. And that's the role of the media, is to provide that level playing field, right? The government officials all have their paid spokespeople, but the media is there that everyone can be heard. I was actually teaching a class at Columbia Journalism School. I was invited in to speak. And one of the journalism students, when I talked about who gets invited on Nightline, you know, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting did a study of that. It was years ago. And they said something like,
more than 90% or non-labor issues, more than 95% of the people speaking on that are corporate executives. More than 90% of the people on Nightline are white. It's 95% are either government politicians or corporate executives, something like that, going through all of those categories. And someone in the class raised their hand and said, well, you really think it's Nightline's job to provide a soapbox for other people? I mean, why do they have to provide the soapbox? I said, wait a second, the soapbox is there. You're right in saying the soapbox. The question is, who gets to stand on that soapbox? And the fact is, it is a minority elite. And I'm not talking about people of color. A very small strata of society gets represented in the media. We have to break the sound barrier. That is our job. Think about in old times. I mean, segregated beaches, buses, blacks go to the back. It's the same thing with our national treasure, our public property, except you're not even lucky enough to get in at all. And it's going to take organizing and strategizing, because they are reinforcing class differences, racial differences, gender differences in this country. They are accentuating them by continually bringing us such a narrow sector of society that more and more people feel alienated, because at the same time we feel like we have this strange paradox where you feel like that is reality. And it is increasingly not almost anyone's reality. And so we have this explosion of reality TV shows that are the furthest thing from reality that anyone knows. And yet, when it comes to a real reality show, like looking at who dies in Iraq, the media is almost entirely sanitized. Governments know the power of the image. All of them do. Now the Bush administration is in power. He invokes that executive order that says you can't photograph, videotape the flag-draped coffins, the body bags of soldiers coming home. You get it sometimes under the Freedom of Information Act. We don't even see wounded soldiers. They come home under cover of night. And so, is it any surprise that kids can't take war seriously? It looks like a video game, the gray, grainy image with the target, or the playing cards. My shock, and I don't know why I continue to be shocked, when I watched CNN one day at the beginning of the invasion, they were talking about one of the Iraqi officials who'd gotten caught, and they said the Force of Spades had just been captured. And they showed the full playing card. I mean, it's one thing to show the photograph of the person inside, if that's the only place you can get it from, but the entire playing card. So kids see playing cards, video targets, playing cards, gray, grainy images. What's the big deal? And yet, if we saw for 1 week, babies dead on the ground, women with their legs blown off from stepping on cluster bombs, U.S. servicemen and women dying, seriously wounded, for 1 week, people would say no in this country. Americans are compassionate. Americans would say that war is not the answer to conflict in the 21st century. We have to demand that the media tell the truth, or I should say, tell the truths, because there are many. The media has to open up and let us hear from all the different populations of people in this country. When you have whole populations targeted, it's always African Americans. And now it's Arab Americans, Muslims, people of South Asian descent. We hear over and over again, this is a demonized population. Is it any surprise that the soldiers in Iraq treated them as subhuman? And they need more than the standard 8 or 9 second soundbite to explain why they feel the way they do, what they believe, what their religion is, what countries they come from, or the fact that they may have been born here. And most importantly, we need to hear the debates in their communities. Because that's what breaks down stereotypes. That's what breaks down caricatures. Any more than any of us, people have debates in their families, in their communities, and they're vibrant, and they don't agree with each other. And suddenly, if you're listening to that kind of discussion, let alone one person, since almost no one is included in the national discussion now in the corporate media. But if you hear those discussions, you'll say, oh my God, he sounds like my Uncle Bob, and I can't stand him. That reminds me of my grandmother. Oh, I wish she would be quiet. And that's important. It's not about liking someone, but it's understanding their humanity. And that simply comes from hearing people speak. The only way it's going to change, and I think the beginning is here, the beginning is in St. Louis, the beginning is the World Trade protests or the World Trade Organization protests in Seattle. It started. It's not starting at ground zero right now. The proof is Michael Powell. He learned a mighty lesson. Millions of people care about the media. They want a media that reflects what's going on. It really is about the future of this country, because especially young people feel completely alienated. And those voices, too, have to be included, and we have to reflect what our communities look like, or they will be increasingly marginalized because they are the biggest consumers of media going. It's up to all of us. We need a democratic media to build a democratic society.
I see people already lining up to get questions and comments going. That's great. Let's start here.
Thanks, everyone. It's been really great listening. So let's say I want to get more involved. I want specifics on what anyone here can do as a single person or together, aside from talking to my friends, already doing it, aside from joining an email, activist group, already doing it. Specific ideas for... This is like, as you were saying, kind of the start of a movement, Amy. But it's not a movement yet. And a lot of people, I would hate to see people leave here saying, oh, this has been great. Okay, what's on TV tonight? I want a beer, and I'm going to have pizza. Okay, specifics on what to do next, that's all.
Well, I can, how long you got? A number of different levels, and I'll go quickly. One, make an appointment immediately with your legislators. Call them up. Write them letters. What's that? Why aren't your legislators here? That's a good question. Go there and ask them that question. Ask them where they stand on all these issues. I guarantee your legislators do not understand these issues any better than you do. When you ask them, they will be inclined to ask a staffer to learn about them. That's step one. Go talk to your legislators. Write a letter to the editor in your local newspaper. Write for your local independent newspaper. Go on the air in your local radio station. Talk about media issues to a broader audience than those in your friends and family circles. Read up. Become very knowledgeable about the issues you care about. These are the first steps towards building movement. Reach out to those groups that are organized in issues that do have a movement, like the trade union movement, like the environmental movement, like the civil rights movement. Let them know that your issue and their issue are one and the same, that we're all about social justice, and to hear about the issues that matter in our society, we need a democratic media. Freepress.net, I'll give a plug to my website. We have all kinds of materials there, toolkits that give you step-by-step instructions about what's the best way to call your legislator, how do you speak to them to make them respond. what's a format for a letter to the editor, to a letter for a letter to the FCC. All these things make a difference. They seem like a drop in the bucket when you're doing them, but if all of us did them, I guarantee it would make an impact.
I use the example of the what's happening around Getting Democracy Now on television and radio around the country. It's been absolutely remarkable, the growth. A couple of years ago in 2001, we were broadcasting on several dozen community radio stations, among them WEFD. Then afterwards, we expanded to television, understanding how powerful television is. That's where most people get their information. And then the growth of the show just took off, and now we're on 330 radio and TV stations around the country with 2 to 3 new stations a week picking us up. That's Pacifica stations, NPR stations, public access TV stations, PBS stations, and on both satellite networks, on Dish Network, Free Speech TV, Channel 9415, Link TV, 9410, and on DirecTV, Channel 375, which was also Link. And millions of people access our website where we video and audio stream, have the MP3 up, which allows stations across Canada, Australia, Europe to run us daily. Now, the organizing that's going on around that is remarkable because I think it is putting the public back in public media. Struggles that are all different stages all over the country. It's absolutely incredible. One public radio general manager the other day said, "I'm sorry, I have a firewall against the public." Well, I think that's being challenged when thousands of people sign petitions, they go in, they say, well, what is the process to get programs on? And it's really opening up the discussion about who gets to choose what's on our public media. That's our what we call our public media. Let's not forget that the networks are also using the public airwaves. And the fact is that as, well, they consider you consumers, you also have a choice there. The most interesting part of this is what they're finding and why it's growing so quickly is the level of support they're getting when they put the program on. And the program is about bringing out diverse voices, and it's turning public radio on its head because they have had a very big problem that they also, public radio, appeals to a very small strata of society. It's mainly more well-educated, white, mainly men. And they've been working very, very hard to try to change that. And Democracy Now! Comes along and it turns that on its head in every community, brings out much more diverse audience and a younger audience. And so all of those people come out to push for it and they say, we have a firewall up. You can't just tell us what to do. Well, why not? If enough of the community mobilizes and says, we want to hear what's going on. And I'm also always struck by how hopeful people find the show when it deals with such difficult issues all the time. But there is something about knowing, simply knowing, where then when you say, what can we do, you find something to do. If you, as you were saying, identify the problem. And also you find out all of the groups that are involved in these issues in all different ways. You don't have to reinvent the wheel every single time. And you work with the internet in getting that information, but you have to know the websites to go to and where it is and what the groups are involved and if there are any in your community, can you set up chapters? But a lot of this is already being done, and it's a matter of linking you to it. And so I encourage people, you know, try in your community to bring Democracy Now! There because it opens a whole new universe, yes, of independent and international media to you. How you link up when it's closing down in this country to hear other perspectives, but then never give up on this country because it is the most powerful country on earth and the media are the most powerful tools. They're the most powerful tools to stratify society, but also to equalize it.
Susan Douglas, the University of Michigan, and in these times, we all agree that the corporate news is abysmal and on television and especially on cable, but we all know what they say. They say, what can we do? We're just giving the people what they want. And then they say, when we have international news on, our viewership declines. But when we give them the Michael Jackson case, or God help us, the runaway bride, or Terry Schiavo, et cetera, they claim that their viewership increases. So I would like each of the panelists to say what your various and multiple refutations are when you hear this line from them.
I think that there's some truth to what they say. And part of that is that the issues that we confront on this planet are extremely complex, and we denigrate education in this country. And people in this country are encouraged to believe that they don't really need to pay attention, certainly to anything that's outside of our borders. And there's an immense amount of hypocrisy in this country. You know, we talk about moral values, and yet we have these soap operas and now primetime television shows and everything that are extremely, I won't even call them sensuous or sexual. I mean, just almost explicit. I think part of what we have to, what we're up against is the question of how issues are explained to people. I come out of the labor movement, and the labor movement has a long history of denigrating education. And very often you'd have trade union leaders that would say almost what corporate media people say. The members aren't interested in education. They just want, they want to make sure the union takes care of them, et cetera, et cetera. What we found when we started doing something several years ago called Common Sense Economics, which was an economic education program to engage people in a discussion about class and capitalism, is that workers were really interested in this. And one of the reasons that they were interested is that they were interested when we were talking with them, not at them, when concepts were basically broken down, and when a framework was created. And when the media talks about presenting international issues or other issues, it rarely breaks down issues in a way that people can get. It just seems so completely overwhelming and very disempowering, because you walk away, after you see a disaster in Darfur or whatever, and you feel like, what can I do? There's nothing I can do. Or you draw even worse conclusions. When it comes to Africa, Africa's a basket case. Africa will never be right. And so part of what I think has to be central to media reform is really re-articulating how messages need to be addressed and what we want to see being presented. International media can be presented in ways that is completely understandable. We just have to treat people like they're intelligent as opposed to as if they're idiots.
My response to that is it what they want or is it what they're used to? I think people don't go to cable news channels anymore to watch news. They go to cable news channels to be entertained. We've got to the point where we don't expect news from the TV. We expect entertainment. And when we actually get news, it's boring. We turn the channel and the ratings go down. It's a long-term problem that has to be solved by a reinvestment in the education process, so people actually want to see news on television. They get accustomed to seeing news on television, and suddenly entertainment is not as good an alternative.
I think people do care, and I think that the examples you use, Susan, are very instructive. You said the runaway bride. By the way, I fly so much that I thought they were talking about a runway bride, and I was always looking out the window. No, Terry Schiavo, Michael Jackson. You're talking about three individuals. People are fascinated by individual lives and dramas. And so the media has to focus
on the issues that matter, that have the greatest impact on people in an individual way. We are drawn to stories. And so when we talk about Haiti, we have to talk about a person. You know the whole story. You say 30 million people and your eyes glaze over died, and you talk about one person and we care. And that's human nature. And so we have to do the work of going to those places. Some of those places are right here. The number of kids who wake up hungry every day. What is it in this country? 1 in 4. So let's talk about the little girl and find out if tomorrow Heather is hungry. And you know she won't be, because the whole country will respond. And so you use the same model they use. I don't think it's so much a fascination with celebrity, but with people, with individuals, with human beings. I used to call it we should take the Woody Mia approach to all news. I mean, that's old now, but, right, they split up, he's sleeping with her daughter, and every day you hear that story, and you hear one more thing. You hear he walked outside, she walked inside, she went to court, but you hear the nut of the story repeated. And so soon you're telling your neighbor, and then that person is talking to someone else, because their stories, we're fascinated with individual lives, and that's okay. Use that. Just focus where it matters. And I think people will care. And that's also very powerful for young people in documenting their communities. It's such a great tool in classes to say, tell us about your family. Do an oral history. In New York, there's a project at Grand Central that Dave Isay is doing. It's a booth where you can interview someone. So you bring your mother or your father to this booth, and you do an interview, you have a conversation, and it bestows dignity on a life when you're holding a microphone and you're recording. You're saying, your words are worth something. And that's what the media should be doing. That's what equalizes society. And it's not just, by the way, Vox Pop, going out into the street and saying, what do you think? What do you think? What do you think? Because that's what they do. They either do that, or they go to the corporate executives. I heard about a producer, there was a public radio program, and they filled the audience, and it was talking about poverty in America. And the producer was so proud, she thought she got every group represented. There were welfare moms there, and they were with a group, and there were this and that. And she thought the show was great, and they would stand up and they'd say, I'm so-and-so, I'm with this group, and this is what we're doing. And afterwards, she was excoriated. They said the show was a disaster. And she said, what are you talking about? Everyone was so articulate, and they voiced the problem and said, we didn't want people representing groups. And so you either get those who are part of these think tanks, who are very well versed in what they're saying, or you get the person on the street, the Vox Pop. But there's this whole other sector, I mean, the labor movement, the women's movement, all these people that are delegitimized. And we have to bring them back into the discussion.
I think that this is a really powerful idea, using, you know, media as a tool for leveling the playing field. But as was pointed out, it would be great if there were a lot more people of color in this audience today. And my question is, what do you think can be done on a local, grassroots, community level in the indie media movement to use media more as a tool for empowering people who are marginalized in society, particularly people of color? What can be done to use indie media to empower people of color?
I live right outside Washington, D.C., and I think this is true in most places. The first 5 or so minutes of the regular news is about murders. I mean, when my daughter, who's now 16, was quite young, she couldn't watch the local news because it was basically about murders and house fires. And that's what's held up as very important. I think that our movement needs to challenge that. I think that in terms of the specifics about indie media, I think that what Amy was saying before about the way that democracy now has been built, the kinds of stories that are held up and given legitimacy, I think that that's very important. I mean, when she was talking about the situation in Haiti, there's no no one else that I can think of that was giving the amount of attention to the coup and its aftermath as Amy and Democracy Now. I think that that's part of what we need to be thinking about in the indie media world. Taking these stories that are important to significant constituencies, and legitimizing them and explaining them in ways that people can get.
I'm also interested in this question of race, and specifically in the content that's found on BET since it's been acquired by Viacom, and sort of the elimination of Tavis Smiley and Donnie Simpson on the channel, and the popularization of the comedy shows and other, I think, very stereotypical caricature images of African Americans that are on BET, to exclusion of news and other sort of serious issues. And my question for Bill Fletcher is, do you feel as if this is part of the political project to keep both African American and white audiences who watch BET misinformed about the issues of race and class in America today?
Well, we have to be clear that Bob Johnson was never a Bolshevik. I mean, this is not about the selling of BET to Viacom. We're talking about a project. That is, the creation of BET was done in such a way that there was no real interest in broad-based debate within Black America about issues, both in terms of the way that things were framed in BET, as well as the way that Bob Johnson treated the workers at BET and crushing their unions. I mean, he was very clear in terms of his class interests. I think that he was there to make money. And one of my criticisms, you know, within Black America, we're often very forgiving of people. You know, Clarence Thomas, you know, when Clarence Thomas was up for a nomination, you know, people were saying, give the brother a chance. When he doesn't have to worry about job security anymore, he'll do the right thing. Hey, listen, that's what I heard. Same thing with Bob Johnson. I mean, there was this real desire to see someone, a Black person, who was significant in the media world, and there was hope. There was substituting hope for reality. And I think it's been an incredible disappointment, and I think we have to continue to struggle around that. I think that, again, Bob wanted the money. That was the only thing. There was no political objectives. There was no interest in progress. This was about the Yankee dollar.
As a professor here at the university, I'm very interested in this question of balancing out the media, which it seems largely what we're talking about today. And I was especially interested to hear about Tomlinson's Corporation for Public Broadcasting top-down issues, efforts to balance his corner of the media. The reason it interests me is because all of us in the university, in the state university system, I think will in the next three and a half years have to face this issue as the rumblings are there of trying to balance the universities in terms of their liberal versus conservative lineup, especially state universities. So it strikes me that there's a real relevance to what's being talked about here of underfunded state organizations that may get just a fraction of their budget from the state or the government, being told by the government how they're going to run their business, with the government having 100% of the say. I'm just wondering where we should come out on this whole balance question, because at some level it seems a spurious place to come out. I mean, if you look at the Hardball or the Crossfire, that's one version of balance. Just put one liberal versus one conservative, and is that the kind of balance we're talking about, or is there something else? I ask this as an honest question, because what I worry about with the development of alternative media, which I welcome and I listen to, is that I'm listening to it and no one else is, and it becomes my echo chamber that doesn't have the, it just becomes what I listen to versus what they listen to.
Let me offer a couple of brief answers. One, the issue of balance as a political issue has become a tool of intimidation. It is a ruse. It is a sham, a red herring to put pressure on people to do other things. In my opinion, the pressure in public broadcasting to balance programming is not an effort to foxify public broadcasting, is an effort to alert the people who make the decisions at public broadcasting that their funding is not guaranteed, and that in future they should take good care to watch out for who's buttering the bread. I think that's the same operation going on in the federal agencies. I think it's the same operation going on in state governments and institutions like universities. As to whether alternative media is going to become an echo chamber in and of itself, I think not. I agree with some of the remarks that Amy gave last night that terms like liberal and conservative are beginning to break down, that they don't mean anything anymore because they've become so foggy and so overused and abused in the political climate. So I think to the extent that we use alternative media to present new points of view, that the false dichotomy of liberal and conservative will break down and we'll be left with ideas and their merits and arguments and their persuasiveness. And that, in a democratic society, is where we ought to be.
Thanks. I hope you're right.
Yes, hi. Amy was talking about humanizing stories and telling stories, and I just wanted to share this example. I was recently talking to a friend in Amsterdam in the Netherlands who told me that there's a fairly right-wing government at this time, and they're threatening to deport many of the people who have immigrated there over the recent times. And one of the things that one of the broadcasting services is doing, one of the broadcasters on one of the TV stations there, the TV is handled very differently than it is here, but one of the more popular broadcasting channels, one of the things that they're doing is every night they're profiling different people who are going to be, who are under this threat to be deported. And they're telling the stories of their lives with a lot of detail and really humanizing who they are to try to make it so, make it more difficult when it comes to actually having the government pull this off.
Who's doing this?
It's in Amsterdam in the Netherlands. It's the VPRO broadcasting network.
I was a little concerned about the way of calling broadband a utility as opposed to, you know, making it like a library. I'm latching on to something, but I think it's important how we make our arguments. And I think also the idea of having it being an argument over spectrum and it's the public spectrum, I think there's a broader way that's not an unfair line of attack, but I think we should also look at the idea that there is a right to communicate. There's a right to information. This is enshrined in UN protocols that the U.S., among all the others, hasn't enabled in our own legislature. But it seems to me that if you look at it that way, then it's not just what goes out over the air. It's the cable system too. And maybe the meshing technology of wireless is going to make all that, you know, superfluous, but I don't think so, and not in the near term. And I think it's important to make the argument that we should try to revisit the Telecommunications Act. I don't know when that comes up again, but we should focus on that too, because that included municipalities having the right to have say so over the cable system, and the cable system has to put money into production facilities for the local access. All that's gone by the wayside, and I think that should be part of the discourse as well. And I guess that's for Ben if he wants to. Otherwise, you can, I guess, thoughtfully reflect, I'm sure. Thanks a lot.
Thanks. That's a very sophisticated question. I'll try to answer it without going on too long. First, when I say broadband should be a public utility, I mean that broadband should be universally available and universally affordable. How that system is deployed, who is in control of it, and how it comes about, I'm not that concerned. Different communities can find their own way. Second, I absolutely agree communications ought to be discussed as a right. Increasingly, as we move into the information society and the digital age, words are thrown about pretty haphazardly, but the reality is that access to technology changes people's lives. It increases your standard of living. It increases the likelihood that you will get education. It increases the likelihood that you will get proper health care. It is right and proper to put it into a category of rights. Third, the Telecommunications Act, the broad sweeping legislation that controls much of the industry from telephones to broadband to TV, it is being reconsidered at the federal government, and it's because in the future, the internet will become the medium through which all media is delivered. You will likely have one wire that comes into your house or one antenna on your house that receives a signal, and through that wire or that antenna, you will receive your television, your telephone, your internet access. The rewriting of the Telecommunications Act is a power struggle for who gets control of that wire. And at the moment, the number of public interest voices, consumer voices at the table, are very few, and it is very worrying.
Hi. I'm really glad that Bill had brought up, and now a couple of people have mentioned the issue of race when we're talking about figuring out what to do about the media and the fact that the majority of this audience is white. And I guess I just have two comments more so that perhaps you could talk on. And that is that, number one, if we're going to become powerful and if we're going to actually make a difference with this media, and in effect, by making a difference in the media, we are going to be able to make a difference in the world, hopefully, that we need to reach out within our community. We keep referring to Urbana, just as an example, as a community, but unfortunately, I feel that there's a number of communities, and, well, maybe that's not unfortunate, but it's unfortunate that those communities may have common goals and are not working together. And so I think the first thing that we need to do is to reach out to the other communities within this larger community and physically reach out, go into other areas, go into neighborhoods that are not connecting and say, look at what we're doing in downtown Urbana. We're making an independent newspaper. What do you have to say? And which leads me to the second point is that we need to, I love the fact that we're so aware of world events, and this is a really great thing and it's important, but we also need to be addressing local issues. Urbana Middle School has over 50% of Urbana Middle School children, 6th, 7th, and 8th graders, 1,000 6th, 7th, and 8th graders, over 50% of them are low income, qualify for free or reduced lunch, breakfast in the morning. And that's huge, and we don't hear that talked about. And there are neighborhoods in which we could go to and say, look at this independent newspaper, look at these independent media resources, please talk about these issues. And I think that by opening up communication and by opening up the issues into local issues, then we will empower those people who will make this movement so much bigger, this auditorium full, this auditorium one-third full of African Americans and half full of people of color. And that's all.
We have time for just two quick questions. So I think you're next, and then...
I've been here the whole day, and I've yet to hear this two-word phrase, antitrust law. It's really remarkable to me. There's been a lot about broadcast regulation, but, for example, when the FCC fell asleep in 1999 when Viacom applied to merge with CBS and they let it go forward, every duopoly they've approved is arguably a lessening of competition in that local market. The Clayton Antitrust Act of 1914 makes lessening of competition illegal. Okay. When you have a case, for example, another antitrust case, gives us a definition of freedom of expression that I think is really very useful. This was in the Columbia Broadcasting System versus Democratic National Committee of 1973. Freedom of speech doesn't exist in the abstract. On the contrary, the right to speak can flourish only if it's allowed to operate in an effective forum, whether it be a public park, a schoolroom, or a radio or television frequency. The First Amendment embodies not only the right to be free from censorship, but also the right of an individual to utilize an appropriate and effective medium for the expression of his or her views. I'd like the panel to comment, because this is in the law. We don't have to have a communist revolution to have the kinds of reforms we've been talking about all day. All we need to do is to activate the law that already exists.
I'm going to ask that whoever comments be brief, because we have only about another minute here.
I can answer the question quickly. You're right, but those who have the power to enforce the antitrust laws have no interest in doing so. That's a short answer.
Okay, I think we're going to have to break. I was told that we had till 5 after 5, and we've reached that time. This has been a blast. I think we are all inspired to go forward, and I want to just leave you with one thought to echo what I take to be the common wisdom, or part of it, of this panel. It's time to go back on the offensive. It's time to move forward.